This is Greg Lozinski, and you're listening to Baseball BBQ.
From the studios of baseball and barbecue in some area of New York, this is episode 239. I am Leonard Hollywood Aberman. Is that good, Jeff? And I am here with Jeff, the old coot Cohen, my illustrious co-host. Jeff, I just threw them for a curve, didn't I?
You did, Leo. You know, I'm calling you Leo because not only did Harry Sue call you Leo, I was editing another episode today and someone else called you Leo. So I'm going to start calling you Leo.
Okay. Well, we should tell people who's on the show.
Yes, we should. We have two authors, one barbecue and one baseball. And we have barbecue is Mo Kayson, Big Mo Kayson. And he has a new barbecue book out, new cookbook. It is fantastic.
And, oh, yeah.
And the baseball, we have Noah Cattell, who wrote Baseball, the movie.
Yes, he did. And this is really a great book. We get into it with Noah, but I'm just going to tell you guys, so many of these baseball movies you've seen, but the way Noah talks about them, you'll be like, wow, I didn't know that. So, really good information. But before we get to all of that, let me tell everybody that Bet Online, it's your number one source for all your summer sports this season, from MLB, golf, NBA, and NHL playoff stats. All the latest stats, news, and scores available to follow your favorite teams. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest team matchups, player props, and odds on just about every sport out there. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Bet Online, where the game starts. And Jeff, we're going to start episode 239 by just wishing someone the best, the longest running guest co-host on the Baseball and Barbecue Show. Doug, he's gone rogue shiding, has a new line of rubs out.
Oh.
And you could do an ooh and an ah. Go ahead, Jeff.
Ooh and ah. I hope he mentions the Baseball and BBQ podcast on his label.
What kind of label would it be if he didn't? So he has three rubs out, and I just wanted to wish him all the best and just let everybody know they are high quality, really good rubs. You can go to roguecookers.com and you'll find them there.
And yes, and we know someone who actually made a purchase. So thank you, our friend Anthony Marasco.
Yes, he did. And I hope he's enjoying it. I know he got a new grill and he's now making steaks. And so he needed a high-class rub for his high-class grill.
Absolutely.
All right. And speaking of barbecue, Jeff, do you love the segue?
I love the segue, yes.
Our first guest is Mo Kayson. And Mo has his cookbook. And that cookbook we're going to talk about in the interview. But it is Big Mo's Big Book of Barbecue from award-winning pitmaster Mo Kayson. Listen to this and we'll see you after. Baseball and barbecue listeners, this one's an exciting one. If you looked up barbecue in the dictionary, besides the definition, there might be a picture of this gentleman. Please don't call him an overnight success, you know, because he's not. He worked his butt off, and we're going to hear all about that. But he is Big Mo Kayson. He's a U.S. Naval veteran chef. TV host of the National Geographic series World of Flavor and award-winning pitmaster. But why is he joining us? Because he's now an author. He's coming out with a cookbook, and I'm going to just read the beginning of it. Introduction. It's all about family. I'm Mo Kaysen. Nice to meet you. Maybe you've seen my face on a jar of barbecue sauce or on my National Geographic television series, World of Flavor with Big Mo Kaysen. Maybe you know me best as a competition barbecue pitmaster. All of that is true. And yes, it's still crazy to me that after more than 20 years of working the night shift at a water company in Des Moines, Iowa, my full-time job is now barbecue. I still get giddy every day. And the fact that I get to speak to the guys on the Baseball and Barbecue podcast is the topper. Thanks for putting that in there, Mo. So,
awesome, man.
Welcome to Baseball and Barbecue, Mo Kaysen.
Welcome, Mo.
Man, thank you, man. I'm glad to be here, man. I really am.
And it's wonderful to see you again. Before we were recording, Len was saying that we met you at the Monolith Monster Fest with Bob Trudnack, and we had a great time. We took a couple pictures, so that's in my phone. And we welcome you back to welcome to Baseball and BBQ. And I want to say thank you for your service in the Navy. And I was reading about your book, you know, the Big Mo's Big Book of BBQ, and your introduction is all about family. It was fascinating. Your grandmother had 17 children.
Yeah, she had 17 kids, man, and she was an awesome woman, man. She loved her kids. She loved her grandkids. She was a wealth of knowledge. Everybody respected her. She was a general. I mean, she kept every single of those kids in line, but everybody loved her and everybody respected her.
That's wonderful. Yep.
Now you've got a cookbook coming out. I love cookbooks. I am one of those people that collects them, loves them. And Mo, this book, If you allow me for a second, pardon the pun, to blow some smoke, this is a beautiful book. I mean, the recipes are great. Okay, I made a couple already. But the pictures, I love a cookbook. I was going through trying to clean out some things, and I came across a couple of cookbooks that didn't have pictures in them. There's something disappointing about a cookbook that doesn't have pictures, you know, and Even some of the cookbooks.
I agree.
You had to make all of these things and have it all photographed. So, and you had to make it to perfectly, right? I mean, you couldn't just, because the picture has to be perfect.
Yeah, but they're good. They're great recipes. And National Geographic, I feel honored that they approached me about doing a cookbook because I have such high respect and regard for National Geographic. I've been reading National Geographic books ever since I was a kid, and I was fascinated at all the photography. And they really know how to put pictures together and to create a story. And these images are great. And so I was blessed to be able to have four photographers I could choose from. Wow. And I picked a guy named Jordy Horton out of Austin. And because, you know, I looked at the portfolio and I looked at the images, and his images seemed like they spoke to me, and they were barbecue heavy, which I like, grilling heavy. And I just loved the way and he was such a gentleman. The dude came up to my house. We shot up there. I came down to Austin and shot, and he was just an awesome, awesome photographer and a wealth of knowledge. And he just, I love all his work. So he did the, he did an awesome job shooting my picks and my recipes. And I just feel thankful that I had a great photographer, and then I had a great company like Nat Geo Books to put it all together and to back it.
And Mo, I mentioned that because we did have a photographer on once who, you know, specialized in cookbooks, and he specifically told us, when you take a picture of a steak and that steak is supposed to be at a certain temperature, it has to be at that temperature, because when you take that picture, you can see in the picture if it's not. And there's, and exactly. All these, so that's why I mentioned that.
Yeah, because that's exactly right. You know what I mean? I don't care if you're cooking a hamburger. I don't care if you're cooking some grilled fish. That optimum of what your recipe calls for and how you do it and what you want it to look like has to be at the peak when you do it. And you have to be right there on the spot taking those pictures.
So, Mo, I agree 100% with Leonard. The pictures are great. I mean, you have pictures of your family, your twin sister, Marilyn, with a big smile on her face. That's wonderful to see. Your wife, Nina, and the family. Even your car. You had a car Dodge, a 1969 Dodge you have in there.
Yeah, that's my car.
And your smoker, which you named Little Blue. But I wanted to ask you, your origin beginnings in barbecue, and reading on in your introduction, you look like you did research dating back to indigenous and Afro-Caribbean peoples. So could you talk a little about that?
You know, for me, the way I look at barbecue's from the South. And when I mean by South, I mean the South. It started with, obviously, slaves and Afro-Caribbean people that were brought into the country. And they brought their cooking skills and spices and things. That wasn't here. There was Native Americans, and they were cooking the way they cook. But as far as what we call traditional barbecue, that is created by, for me, it's Black folk. That type of origin and those folks, that to me is where barbecue is actually the roots, because they're the ones doing the cooking. They're the ones doing the slaughtering. They're doing it all. You know what I mean? And they're feeding their family, their friends, the neighborhood. They would get these rough cuts, the leftovers, off of hogs and stuff. And they were taking these hogs and they were putting them in the ground and cooking them the way they were taught through their ancestors. And that's what I truly believe and know, to my knowledge. And so it's a beautiful, humble beginnings, and how it spread throughout the country. And now look at it today. It's a global, and people are always grilling all over the world. But as far as American style, low and slow barbecue, that was from, Afro-Caribbean people, man.
Yeah. And Mo, I'm going to tell you, one of the recipes that I made is the Big Mo's barbecue pork balls. Those are good. Those are really good. I recommend those. And how did you come up with that one?
I did a thing for, some meat supplier. It was either Hormel or somebody. And I had to come up with a recipe. That's a nice little tailgating thing. I think we did it at a Kansas City Chiefs game, home game. And I just made them, and they're simple, they're delicious, and they're easy to cook, and they're great finger food for when you're at a tailgate or at a party. And that's what I love about my cookbook. All my recipes in there, they're nothing overly complex. You know what I mean? And another thing that really means a lot to me, it's my family, my wife, my kid. My wife passed away last November, so she's unfortunately not around to see the book's release. But she was an integral part of helping me put the book together. So was my oldest daughter. And, they were, and then all my daughters put, their recipes in there. So it's a family thing for me. To me, it's really important. And so there's the cookbooks out there, very nice and very beautiful, but very complex. Mm-hmm. But then the average person, I cook, I'm an average guy. And so I cook, I speak to people. I speak to the average person. I'm not speaking to some, Michelin star chef. I'm not speaking to, I'm speaking to people that are just for real working class. I mean, all types, but that's who I am. That's how I came up. And so I'm going to cook to what feels good to me and what tastes good. It doesn't have to be overly complex. It just has to taste good. And I'm all about textures and flavors, and I walk my walk. So my flavors are my flavors, and that's what they are. You know what I mean? I've always been that way. I mean, my grandmother had 17 kids, and she was an awesome cook, and she watched my sister and I a lot as my mom worked two jobs. She was a seamstress. So she worked two jobs, from sun up to sundown. And so we go to my grandmother's, and which was a few blocks away, and she would watch it till my mom got off of work, till we were old enough to walk home and take care of ourselves. But her food was always delicious. I don't care. It could be as simple as a peanut butter jelly sandwich. My grandmother did it. It was just awesome. And her food was always good. And I always remember that of her. She was just a really good cook. But, you know, she had 17 kids, man. She didn't have a lot of money. So she had to put it down. She had to make the best of what she had. You know, and that's kind of the way I like. I like to be able to cook things that are simple but good and fulfilling. And things doesn't have to have 59 spices and all that in order to be, you know, I, that's not me. You know, I'm cooking really good recipes. They're solid. And there's something that I grew up on. And it's something that I like.
Big flavor, not a lot of ingredients. I mean, yeah, when I tell you, sometimes if I look at a recipe, if I'm looking for something and I see a recipe with too many ingredients or too many steps, my eyes glass over and I like, I don't have all day to make this meal. So these recipes, yeah, some of them are a little more complex than others, but for the most part, these are pretty simple. It looks like full of flavor. You have something in the book, in the family section, Mo. And by the way, I just want to tell you, you know, we're very sorry for your loss. You mentioned your wife. My mom wasn't going out and buying me steaks. I would sometimes go hunting and kill a squirrel or a rabbit, or I would go down to the river and catch a sunfish, maybe a bass, and cut it up. In the kitchen, I'd grab my mom's spices and make little concoctions. I would season up these fillets with cinnamon and cardamom. And this is what I love. Things that I would never do today. I would cook it, maybe burn it. Then I would taste it, and it would be straight garbage. But you gotta burn some crap before you get it right.
That is so true, man. That is so true. I can't tell you all the concoctions that I used to put together. And my mom had a great spice rack in her cabinet. And I would just look at ingredients and put it together and try to make a rub and things that, like I said, I would never do today. But that's how you learn. I mean, you gotta burn some stuff up. You got to make some trash first before you get it right. Nobody's going to walk out the gate and just nail it. You got to learn to understand flavors and textures. And that's one thing I have to say about another thing about my grandmother, my mother. My mother, she understood textures and flavors. And that's one thing that I think one of my shining points is that I understand textures. Okay. No matter how tasty your ribs are, your pork ribs, if your ribs are undercooked or overcooked, then you failed. You know what I'm saying? And same thing with brisket. You can have a great tasting brisket, but if it's undercooked, it's chewy. If it's overcooked, it's going to dry and fall apart. You failed. So texture to me is really important. There's certain brisket should have a certain texture to it when it's cooked right. Ribs should have a certain texture when cooked right. No matter what your flavor is. I mean, you can have just simple salt and pepper, or you can have some 14 spice blend. But if the texture is not right, then you are shooting yourself in the foot. I always felt that way. Like, and that's why when I was on the TV shows as a judge, we kind of, me and mine and Tuff, we all balance each other out because, you know, we all have an individual taste. We also have different, what we think differently about texture. You know, and so it was always kind of a good mixture of when it came down to judging on these entries. But I'm a big texture guy. I mean, when I'm judging, even though it's taste, texture, and what's appearance, taste, and texture, texture to me is super important. Taste is also right there, but texture, man. I mean, if your proteins are not cooked right, I'm going to score you down on it big time.
You know, before I ask my question, I just want to let you know that when we met you at that Monolith Monster Fest, you seemed to enjoy serving people because you had a big smile on your face. Everybody talking to you, I can tell in your book you had a big smile. So you are just—it seems that you really enjoy, you know, what you do for a living. And that gets to my question: you started competition cooking in 2006, so 18 years ago, and competed in more than 35 states. What got you into competition cooking?
So, like, when I got out of the Navy, in 93. And one of the first things I bought when I got out of the war, I went to Walmart, bought me a little cheap Brinkman offset smoker because I wanted to get back to cooking again because I enjoy it. It's relaxing to me. I love cooking barbecue. So I was on my back deck just cooking we cooked, we ate out on the grill, I don't know, 3-4 times a week, man. I mean, that's how much I liked it and cooked for my family. I don't care if it's simple hamburgers or if it's steaks or ribs or whatever. And I didn't know anything about, I didn't know anything about competitions and all that. I all of a sudden turned the TV on and I'm seeing the early shows of Barbecue USA and these cook-offs and, you know, and I was just mesmerized. I'm like, what? There's actually barbecue competitions and trophies? And, oh, man, I was hooked. I was hook, line, sinker, man. And so what I did was I just kept watching these shows and, like, I was just getting more and more excited. And then I just kept cooking in my backyard, which I was going to do. I do anyway. But I'm like, man, I really, really, really want to do competitions. I like to get into that. Then I started looking and seeing how much these pits are and trailers. And, you know, at the time, I worked at Des Moines Water Works as a water treatment operator. I made probably like $50,000 a year, and my wife worked for the phone company. We got kids, you know what I mean? You know, I was blown away at what a decent smoker costs. I was in a trailer, and I was like, you know, there are thousands of dollars. And I was just like, man, I don't have the money to do that. I don't know how I'm going to get the money to do something like that, you know, because I really, really wanted to get into it. And so we had a little 800-square-foot house that we lived in that I bought from my friend when I got out of the Navy. And it was about it was four houses down from the house I live in now. And my wife was like, this house on the corner they were living now, that house just got redone. It's an old 1896 home. And it got redone and got went on the market. And she knew, I was like, man, we need to get a bigger house anyway because our family's growing. And so we bought it. So I had this house that was four houses away from me, a little 800-square-foot ranch. And I was like, well, how am I going to make money? I'm thinking, well, why don't I do the flip it, you know what I mean, where you gut it and redo it. Even though I am not skilled in any of those trades, but I had friends of mine that all did stuff. I had, you know, tile guys, I had plumbers, electricians, all good buddies of mine, you know, roofers, you know, guys that do that for a living, electricians. And I took a year out of my salary, didn't go to the bank for no money, funded it out of my pocket 100%, paid all the guys cash. They didn't like try to rake me over the coals. They were my friends, so they took care of me. And I ended up I went to Habitat for Humanity and I bought scratch and dent cabinets or paint. There's nothing wrong with them. They were donated by a home builder or whatever. And I was able to put $11,000, including labor, in this little 800-square-foot ranch after a year. And I put it on the market. And the realtor, it sold in 1 week for $89,900. And I bought the house for $24,000. That was mind blowing for me. I was just like, oh my God, this is, you know, it was amazing. And now I knew right then and there, I had the money to take a little portion of that and buy my trailer. And that's when I bought my first like commercial type smoker and heavy duty type barbecue trailer. And I was just like thrilled. I was like a little kid. And I remember doing my first cook-off in 2006 in Des Moines, and it was called the Pork Barber Colossus. It was all pork cook-off, but it was a big thing. It was my first time ever first time doing a cook-off. And I remember driving into the fairgrounds and looking at all these different smokers and all these people and the smoke in the air and the smells. And I said to myself right then and there, I said, this is where I need to be. So this is exactly where I need to be. And I did my first cook-off, fell in love with it, worked hard. It was hard work because I was by myself. But I completed it because I'm a kind of person, I'm a grinder. Did 20-something cook-offs that year by myself. And I said, I just love it. And I end up just doing cook-offs every year. And then I start branching out outside of Iowa, going to Nebraska, going to Minnesota, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, Texas. Then I start branching out further, you know, Oregon, Idaho, you know, just start going out to all these places, you know, because I'm a people person and I love seeing new ways of doing things and watching these people and watching all these pits and all these smells and just taking it all in and just educating myself. And I end up doing a lot of cook-offs over the years and all over, man. I've been blessed. The only places I haven't really been was like the upper East Coast, like Vermont and up in the Connecticut. I never did anything up there, but most of the center block of the country I've been to, you know what I mean? And a little bit out west, and just love it, man. I had a great time. I learned so much by just getting into my truck and my trailer and going and cooking. And then, you know, the big thing is just making all these rubs in my kitchen and sauces and all these concoctions and taking them out on the road and seeing how they do. You know what I mean? And then, you know, and there's a lot of failure. But then you start, when you start getting it dialed in, then you start getting success. And that made me drive even more. You know what I mean? It's like, I didn't care if I got 18th place in brisket. It was me. It was my rub. I cooked it. And then it starts getting to where you're top five. Then it's a first place or third place. Or that's when you know that you start having, that's when you know you got a good process. Your cooking process, your rubs, whatever you're doing, your spritzes, your sauces, you're starting to figure it out and you're starting to understand. And to me, that's the best lesson, man.
Now, Mo, you know, I said in the intro that people, you know, some people might say, oh, overnight success, but that is not far from it. And you've been telling us all about it. I mean, for 10 years, and this is in your book, 10 years, your routine was to work overnights at your 9-to-5, well, overnight job, and then competing on the weekends, and then back to your overnight job. You worked very hard.
Yeah, and I worked very hard, but I also, too, I got to give kudos to my late wife, because she was holding it down.
Right.
When I was out there going out every weekend, going out doing cook-offs, and coming back and being gone for the whole weekend. And she was an awesome, awesome human being, because there's a lot of people, you know, in marriages, they wouldn't tolerate that. Especially right. When you got babies at home, too. Oh, no. No, no, no. And my wife, I mean, believe me, I got an earful a number of times, but she was understanding. She knew she can look in my eyes. She can tell, you know, I always took care of my family, man. My family didn't go without. Always. I never right. took barbecue over my family. You know, it was like my family's my number one thing. But then also my barbecue was growing and I was enjoying it and I was passionate about it. And I didn't know that it was going to take me here to where I'm standing right now, but it has. And I remember coming back from a cook-off one time and, you know, my wife called me and we had some words, and because I ran out of money on the road for fuel, because that's how slim it got at times.
Wow.
There's times where I would calculate if I had 300 miles to go, I knew exactly how much diesel my truck took. And I can kind of look at my app and see where the wind direction was coming from. And I can calculate. I'm a big Dodge guy, big Dodge diesel guy. That's all I've owned. And I kind of knew my truck. And so it's like I knew that I had this, it's going to take this amount of gallons to get to the cook-off and home. And there was a couple times where the wind changed big time and the headwind was crazy. And I would get halfway home and I can realize I don't have enough money to get home. So I had to pull in the Walgreens, call my wife, have her Western Union me $40. And that only happened like once or twice. And I remember getting an earful from her, you know, because we got babies at home. We got bills to pay. We got to take care of business, which we always did. And I remember, you know, she was pretty upset about it, even though it's $40. But, you know, you're thinking you're not making a lot of money. $40 is a lot. Especially mm-hmm. when you got to buy food and stuff like that. And I remember walking in from coming in from off the drive, and she's in the living room, and I sat down with her, and I told her, I said, look, one day barbecue's going to pay me back. That's what I told her. And she looked at me. She goes, you know, whatever. Okay. You know, and I said, it is. And as my life has progressed through this barbecue world, she realized I was right. She realized I was right. And she was so, so proud of me. And she's seen my grind and my ethic of my work ethic of that and how much I cared about it. You know, how much I care about, you know, barbecue. And I remember, man, she just hugged me. You know, this is before she got sick, but, you know, she was always proud of me. And all my kids, all my girls, they were always proud of me. They are proud of me. So it's family for me, man. You know what I mean? I'm in the position now to be able to take care of my kids the way I really want to take care of my kids. Right. You know what I'm saying? I quit my job working at the water company in 2017. And that was a gamble. That's telling me I was tired of working at the water plant. It was a great job. I took care of my family, paid the bills. But Mo Kaysen likes to do a lot of nice things. I like smoking good cigars. I like Luke Casey boots. I like eating good. I like my kids eating good. And that costs money. You know what I mean? I don't just settle. Even when I worked at a water plant, I worked two jobs. I'd go be a casual postal carrier for the U.S. Post Office. I would go drive a cream truck for our dairy, along with my 40-hour-a-week water treatment job. I always hustled, man. I always hustled. To be able to be in the position now, to be able to come and go as I please. I remember telling my wife, I said, you know, she kind of knew it was just kind of, it's like watching grass grow. I was passing up a lot of opportunities because I had to do my 11-to-7 shift because I was regimented in that way. But then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be one of those guys that retires. There's nothing wrong with that. There's guys that retire, do 30 years. And I wasn't that far away from that, but it was like 30 years. And then you see him driving a security truck or something like that. Nothing wrong with that. Do each his own. Right. Your piece is your piece. But I knew dang well Mo Queso wasn't going to do that. It's just, that's not me. And so you got to create your own wealth. You got to create your own. And that's why I love small business, because you got to get out there and you create your own. Okay. And there's nothing wrong with city jobs, because I've had that for all my life. I worked for the government and I was in the Navy. I always had a job like that where someone was telling me what I need to do. And I got to a point in my life where I said, I need to do what I want to do. And I quit November of 2017. I walked away from the water plant. I have a full pensioner. I said, I'm okay, son. And that's the thing that I'm proud of. She knows who's at the water plant. And then she sees what's happening now, or when she seen what happened as I was progressing through my life, you know, with this barbecue thing, and she realized. And then, you know, what gave me the courage to do that was Academy Sports, which is a sporting goods chain down in Texas. And they have a nice little barbecue section that they are really known for, like rubs and smokers and things of that nature. And they called me and they said, Mo, we want to carry your rubs. After that time, no big box store reached out to me. It was just like, you got to go kind of sell basically like rub out of your back of your truck. You know what I mean? Yeah, I got a couple cases. Well, when Academy Sports reached out to me and said, hey, man, we want to carry your rubs. I drove down to Katy, Texas, which is right side, just west of Houston. Went to the corporate office, sat in their boardroom. We talked about it. And at first, they only wanted to do 25 stores. But what they want to do is they want to see where you're at. They want to see if you're the man behind the rub. Because a lot of people put their names and stuff and just sell it, have no idea about it. They just put their name on it trying to cash. And they see my passion about me talking about my rubs. And they just said, you know what, Mo, we're going to put you in all of our stores. That was 300 stores at the time.
Wow.
And they said, this is what a potential PO looks like. And so when I went home, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm done with the water plant. And so I quit. And it was rough for a couple of weeks, you know, because you think about it. I mean, I'm used to doing 11 to 7, Monday through Friday for years. And then you're at home at the couch at 11:10, sitting on the couch going, man, did I make the right decision? You got your wife upstairs asleep, kids asleep, and you're sitting on the couch downstairs thinking, God, I hope this is, you know. But just like clockwork, Academy said that the POs will drop about March, and they did, and I haven't looked back since. And now I'm in Ace Nationwide, Academy Sports, Hy-Vee, largest grocery chain in the Midwest, Winn-Dixie, and I just went into Shields. And it's just since 2017. It's a blessing.
Yeah. Congratulations on that. You know, Mo, I was going to ask you is when you go from being Mo Kaysen, who's doing barbecue, who's, you know, doing well, starting to make rubs and stuff, to being Big Mo Kaysen, who is the face of barbecue, certainly one of the faces of barbecue. But I guess because that didn't happen exactly in 2017, it took some time.
Yeah, it was 2010. I gotta thank TV, because TV, no matter what you think about it, that has helped me so much, because especially when you're in the rub sauce business, mm-hmm. you may have a great product, but if there's somebody right next to you who has a great product too, but they're known for being on TV, 9 out of 10 times people are going to grab that rub. Now, it has to still be excellent, great rub and great sauce, because no matter how popular you are on TV, if your rub and sauce ain't no good, it's trash, you hang it up. And that's the one thing about a box store, man. If you don't sell, they'll take you off the shelf. And I haven't been taken off yet. Every store I've been into, I sell. And that's because it is a a testament of me making my own rubs and me not having my name on something that I haven't created. There's a lot of people do that, man. I replace people in stores that are well-known, that were well-known people, and they just put their name to a rub because they just want to cash in or someone gives them opportunity to do that, but they have no idea what the rub's all about. They don't understand the complexity of the rub. They just put their face to it. And to me, that's a disservice. Now, you make your money the way you want to make your money, but everybody knows that when you buy my rub, all my 7 rubs are Mo Kayson. Mm-hmm. All my 3 sauces are Mo Kayson. And I made every single one in my kitchen, every single one. And they've been through the trials and they've been through the ups and downs. And so that is why I think also that it does well, because you got a great product. People understand that you're legit. And then they sprinkle that chicken rub on that chicken and cook it. That's the ultimate bringing it home, because when you cook with that rub and you cook that chicken, bam. Okay, Mo knows what he's talking about.
You know, I was in AC the other day, and sure enough, right there was your bottle of sauce right there. So absolutely, you're mm-hmm. actually in the New York Long Island market as well. So you said nationwide, definitely here. You're a big TV personality, and recently we actually got to meet John Marcus of the Barbecue Pitmasters, and I've seen you being a judge on that show. How do you like judging barbecue competitions instead of being in the barbecue competition?
Oh, it was John Marcus. Them guys were the first ones that gave me my break in TV, to be honest. I mean, I was just a contestant, and they had some judging issues, so they asked me to become a guest judge, and then they made me a judge. And I learned a lot about TV. I learned a lot, the ups and downs of TV. But I have to say, John Marcus, they were the ones that gave me the shot of being a judge. And it just took off from there. It's almost like that black freight train going on down the track. You know, all I need is that little step, that little start, and that chugga, 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 chugga. Then all of a sudden, boy, I'm rolling coal, man. And that's all it takes, you know. But you have to, it's who you are, what you are. Because you could be on TV and you could be as dry as a popcorn fart. I'm just being honest. I know that doesn't sound funny. It sounds crazy, but it's your personality. It's your personality. You have to keep people engaged, but you also have to educate them too. And when you educate them, you got to know what the heck you're talking about. Because the problem is, you can sit there and chitty chat all day long, but if people who know how to cook at home, or people who are watching you, they can see that you really don't know what you're talking about. Or they can look at your food and tell you, no, this is not what I'm talking about. There's guys, we have contestants that would get on there and they would be blowing all kinds of smoke. You can look exactly what they're cooking and you know it's a train wreck. But they're going to try to make it seem like that they know what they're doing. And, you know, you can't fake the front. You know what I'm saying? You got to keep it real, and you got to keep people engaged, and you got people. I mean, when you have a personality and you can make people laugh and you can keep people engaged, that is the magic of TV. Because if you're dry, they're just going to turn the channel and go, I don't care how experienced you are. I don't care how many trophies you got. People don't care about you got a 40-foot trophy at home. They don't care about that. Drop knowledge on them. Keep them engaged. And so they can learn what you're doing and what you're talking about, and that you know what you're talking about. I know what I'm talking about because I've cooked and cooked and cooked and cooked for all these years. So I know what I'm doing. I'm not know everything, but I know what Mo Kayson, you know, I know what I know.
Absolutely. We're talking to Mo Kayson. He's the author of Big Mo's Big Book of BBQ. And, you know, I'm talking to my colleague here, Leonard, who's not really big on sides and barbecue, but you do have a section for sides. And I want to ask you about Big Mama's potato salad. First of all, who's Big Mama? And why is this potato salad wife. So good? Your wife, okay?
That's my wife, yeah. Nina, her mom was Meskwaki Indian and her dad was white. So Nina was, but she was raised basically in the Meskwaki culture. And even though she's from Des Moines, where I'm from, I have to give it to her, because when I met her, she didn't really know a lot of the way I cook and the way my family cooks. And she just gravitated to that. And then she made it her own. And so that potato salad is actually her recipe. But her recipe of her potato salad kind of mimics what I grew up on. I'm a mustard potato salad guy. Mustard with a little bit of mayo. not just straight mustard, mustard, a little mayo. She was an awesome, awesome cook. And so that was her potato salad. And she would check you. If I said anything like, oh, that's my mom's potatoes, oh man. She would that ain't your mom's, that's my potato. Oh, that, you know, she would be quick to check you real quick, check me. And so her recipes are her recipes. And she was an awesome cook, man. And I love that she grew in that. She was a good cook in the beginning. She understood it, but then she became a really, really, really good cook over the years. You know what I mean? Because she likes to eat good. I like to eat good. And we want our kids to eat good. Nobody want to be sitting home with no raggedy food. Nobody want to be eating crazy stuff. Cook it right. You know what I'm saying? Cook it right.
Yep.
And then obviously there's mistakes and stuff that happened. But Nina was an awesome cook, man. And I'm going to tell you, man, she was an awesome woman, man.
Yep. And
it was.
One last one I wanted to ask you about, and because this looks absolutely delicious in the dessert section, Montgomery's Moonshine Peach Crumble. I want to eat the page. Oh, my gosh.
Man, it is so good. Montgomery made that. She loves doing desserts. That's her thing. Desserts is her thing. And I remember I was going to cook-off in Texas, in Lubbock, Texas, held at Texas Tech Stadium. Or not in the stadium, but on the grounds of Texas Tech. And it was a barbecue contest they have every year. And, but they have on Friday night, it's like a, not chop, but kind of like a, it's a contest. So it's like a contest within a contest. So they handpick four or five well-known pit masters. I was one of them, Junior Rhea, Robert Sierra, Harry Sue. I think there was, some of them was us four, there might be one more. And so what they do is Texas Tech has a great meat program where you can actually go up and buy steaks and beef and everything because they have their own program, which is on campus, which is awesome. So we each got a cowboy ribeye. If you didn't know, that's a ribeye with a bone, a short bone, but that's short rib bone. But that's a cowboy ribeye. It's probably inch and a half steak. And you had to cook the steak on right there on your pit. You had to cook a side dish on your pit. And you had to cook a dessert on your side dish. I cooked my daughter's, her, kind of like a peach cobbler, but it's like a dump, but it was fire. Everything was fire. I ended up winning. I won it 2 years in a row. I did two different things, two different years, but that first time it was her dessert that I did for my dessert. And I cooked, I baked it in my smoker. I had a smoker that had a hot box above it that had no smoke. It was just radiant heat. So it got up to like 400 or 500 degrees and I was able to bake in it. And I remember the judges eating that peach crumble and their eyes. And these were like Texas Tech alumni. There was a newscaster from Lubbock. There was the president of Lubbock, I think, of Texas Tech. They're all like celebrity judges. Blew them away. And the thing is, it's the peaches. Ripe, high-quality peaches. They weren't Harry and David's, but they were a place out of Colorado. And I can't remember the name. My daughter knows the name, but we get peaches from there. And they are just super flavorful and juicy. And that makes the whole thing. Because when you got really flavorful, juicy peaches, that's the base. And then everything else is just the background.
Mo, we're very appreciative of your time. And, you know, to tell you how much we were looking forward to speaking to you is really an understatement. But I have two more for you. First, it's a shame that Bo Jackson already had the ad, because all I could think of as you're talking about barbecue is Mo knows barbecue. And, you know, if Bo Jackson didn't already have it, it would be Mo knows barbecue. Mo knows. I have a feeling.
I like to take one of those. There was a cool picture of him with shoulder pads on and a baseball bat. And I should do something similar to that with a barbecue shovel and an apron and no shirt on.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you can have that. I will give that to you. You don't need to. I'll just be honored to see it. But Mo knows barbecue. And then I need a bit of advice from you, because you had your wife was a great cook. You're a great cook. My wife loves to cook and I do too. I'm mostly, you know, outside in the backyard. But how do you handle it when you have two great cooks in the house and you both want that kitchen? Mo, what is the secret?
Well, I was the guy that cooked outside. I can cook, I can bake, I can cook, but I was the outside guy, and Anina was the inside.
There you go.
I mean, she could go out and fire up my smoker, not my big offset, but she'd go fire like get some GMGs in the backyard. If they wanted steak or something, she would fire it up, cook like that. But Nina was an awesome. She cooked great Italian food. She cooked a great, cool, really good dishes of different cultures. So that was her thing. Where I was the person that was the caveman that was cooking a lot of the proteins, like on the grill. Gotcha. And baking on the grill and cooking on the grill. So gotcha. So I let her, like, when she's in the kitchen, I never mess with her. Because she would be, she'll have her towel raked on her waist. And she would have her little music on, and she'd be in the zone. And she didn't want you messing with her, messing with, like, dishes and stuff. I would go and I would taste it. And, like, say, you know, and it may not need anything. And she would look at me and she was like, don't you dare put, you know, white pepper in it. And I'm like, I didn't say I was going to do anything, you know. And she would be like, you know, it was her thing, man. You didn't mess with her food when she was cooking.
There you go. Thank you. That's I'm going to take that advice. I'm going to stay outside. Let my wife have the kitchen. Yep. We are talking to Mo Kayson. His book is Big Mo's Big Book of Barbecue, 75 recipes from brisket and ribs to cornbread and mac and cheese. Be careful when you read this book, because you are going to get so hungry. And this, I've already made, like I said, a couple of recipes from here. I'm looking forward to making many more. Mo,
what'd you make?
I made the meatballs. And I also made your wings.
Mm-hmm.
I made those balls that I mentioned, and the wings. Yes. And I'm going to just go through and do page at a time till I get through the whole book.
There you go.
So,
right on.
We thank you so much for joining us. And how can people, social media, whatever, Jeff usually does this, but I'm going to ask, how do people get in touch with you? Purchase the book. Give us all your details.
Yeah, you can. The books are sold everywhere. Book, I mean, like Barnes & Noble, Target, Penguin. I mean, all the places that sell like cookbooks and books in general.
Gotcha.
You're gonna feel the flying there. Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to go follow me, I got an Instagram. It's Big Mo Kayson on Instagram, on Facebook fan page, and Mo Kayson and. And then my website is mokaysonbarbecue.com. So if you want to like buy swag or some rub or whatever.
I recommend everyone go there, buy the book. Mo, we wish you the best. And we know that you're on the road. You know, you've made a stop at a hotel somewhere. So we really appreciate it. You are dedicated. You gave us your time. Thank you very much. And we hope we get to speak to you soon.
Man, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mo.
All right, everybody.
Mo, thank you very much.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Lynn. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you, Big Mo Kayson, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ with his Big Book of Barbecue. It is a fantastic book, great pictures. Mo Kayson is one of the giants in the barbecue industry.
That's why they call him Big Mo.
Yes, he is.
And Jeff, I said, we're going to see you after the break, but after the interview, even I forget this is an audio podcast. So
metaphorically see you. Yes.
All right, Jeff, give us the gift of the week.
It's time for the quote of the week.
A good friend of mine used to say, this is a simple game. You throw the ball, you catch the ball, you hit the ball. Sometimes you win. Sometimes you lose. Sometimes it rains. Think about that for a while. That was Ebby Calvin Nuke Lelouch played by Tim Robbins in the movie Bull Durham.
Very, very good. Very nice. You know, Jeff, you said sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. You're going to win all the time with baseballbbq.com. Grilling tools and accessories, Jeff.
Yes.
You're always winning with them. It's here. Grilling season. If you haven't gone to baseballbbq.com, I don't know what to do. Jeff, I don't know what to do other than to tell everybody you're going to love it. The tools, you're listening to this show. You love baseball. You love barbecue. You love both. These are tools that combine the two loves. Go to baseballbbq.com.
And let me remind everybody, if you want to reach the show, give us a call at 516-855-8214 and leave a voicemail. You can email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. We have an X at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue's all spelled out. We have a website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, share, subscribe, tell your friends, follow. You know what to do.
Jeff, do you have a favorite baseball movie? Yes, of course you do. All right.
Yeah, but it changes. Everybody asks me, what's your favorite? It changes. I mean, you know, A League of Their Own, Bull Durham, Major League, Bad News Bears.
Wow. Let's talk about all of that and more with Noah Gattell.
Noah Gattell is a journalist, film critic, and lecturer on film and baseball. He has been published in the New York Times, The Ringer, The Guardian, The Atlantic, LA Review of Books, Defector, GQ, Esquire, Elle, and Wired. He is an on-camera reporter for BBC's Talking Movies and presents for Smithsonian Associates on Cinema and the Oscars. We are talking to him about his first book, Baseball, the Movie. Welcome, Noah.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, we're very happy you joined us, and your book will be coming out in May. Go get it. We've read it. It is a fantastic read. Does not profile all baseball movies, but a good part of them, and really makes you think. So I really enjoy reading it, Noah.
I'm glad to hear it. And I know that many people will have a complaint that their favorite baseball movie does not get enough credit. But, you know, the point of the book wasn't just to be an encyclopedia, and I want to make sure people know that going in. It sort of tells the story of the baseball movie, and really, in some ways, the story of America throughout the period that it covers. And unfortunately, some very good baseball movies had to get left by the wayside. So I apologize for that in advance.
And it's also not a ranking of baseball movies. Let's get that clear. It's definitely not.
No, I have a ranking. I have a personal ranking. It's on my Letterboxd account. It goes 82 movies deep, but that's definitely not how the book is structured.
People that love baseball, you're right, they have their favorite movies. When Jeff and I first started doing this podcast and had no clue what we were doing and hadn't started having guests on yet, or they were sporadic, we had an episode where we featured favorite baseball movies, and people love that. What is it about baseball movies that people love so much?
Well, I think they isolate, many of them anyway, isolate the feeling that we love the most about baseball. You know, they look at the way we looked at baseball when we were kids, you know, when the game was really magic and we didn't know about, you know, arbitration or UCL injuries or, you know, sexual assaults and all the terrible things that sometimes are part of the story of baseball. The baseball movie at its best and the best parts of those baseball movies really capture how thrilling this game is. And, you know, as an adult, it's hard to kind of parse through all of the other stuff and get back to that feeling. So for me, watching a baseball movie puts me right back to 1986 when I was 6 years old, watching the ball go through Buckner's legs. And that's a hard feeling to find in life these days. The baseball movie gives it to us.
And in Fever Pitch, the famous scene, the Buckner game.
Oh, my God. That's a movie that I did not get to talk about a lot in the book, but I really, really like, because I'm not a Red Sox fan, obviously, but I think any fan of like a franchise that has a kind of culture of being losers can really relate to that movie and the toll that it takes on you as a fan.
Yeah, and you do mention it in here. It's not a chapter, but you did mention it. You know, let me ask you, I'm not asking, let me just say that my earliest baseball movie that I remember watching was Pride of the Yankees. And I thought that was like the first baseball movie, and it was not. I know Babe Ruth made movies before that, and actually silent movies, which I actually seen. But Pride of the Yankees has got to be one of the top movies and top baseball movies, and not just a baseball movie. It's more of a love story. I mean, I you talk about how they didn't want to make it as a baseball movie.
Yeah, absolutely. At the time, and really for a long time, even after that, baseball movies were considered box office poison. There had been movies made in the 20s and 30s, and none of them were particularly successful. But Samuel Goldwyn, who was the producer of Pride of the Yankees, one of the original titans of Hollywood, he saw in the story of Lou Gehrig something bigger than baseball. You know, and I think we all still do today. But he was quite adamant that this not just be a baseball picture, that it's a love story, that it's a tragedy. And in some ways, you know, I think they saw it as a film that was very much of the moment with America on the verge of World War II. And watching this young man get cut down in the prime of his career and die this dignified death, you know, I think that did speak to the moment in a lot of ways, too. That's why that movie was such an enormous hit and was nominated for all those Oscars. And without that, I don't know that we would have the subsequent 9 decades of baseball movies that we have. Because the success of that movie really made all the rest of it possible. But yeah, I also just think it's a pretty great movie on its own terms.
And the female lead in that, Teresa Wright, that was her third movie?
Yeah, she was so young and so poised on screen. You know, she was known already for being a great crier. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why she got the role. But as I detail in the book, like, she had a lot of spunk and a lot of verve, a lot of self-confidence for a young woman in Hollywood. And I think you can feel that watching her kind of hold her own with Gary Cooper in that movie.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's so great about this book, and I was thinking to myself, you know, Noah doesn't really even need to publicize this book on our show. I'm so glad you are. But you mention a book that's all about baseball movies, I'm buying it.
Yeah.
Okay. But you go so into detail about the different movies. Pride of the Yankees. If people think they know about Pride of the Yankees, I guess again, because you just give the details. You talk about, I think it was Teresa Wright, her contract, how she put in there will be no photos or promotions with me in a bathing suit in a pool. I mean, there was like a whole thing in her contract, and that was fascinating. The fact, I guess, I did not know that that was, they didn't even want to make the movie. Mm-hmm. That was another thing. And in that, you talk about the Babe Ruth movie and how, you know, that was something that was, you know, the Babe Ruth movies weren't that great. I mean, I know Jeff was talking about the, you know, the silent films, the Babe Ruth movies, but, so there's just so many facts in these chapters that fans of baseball and fans of the movies are going to love.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book because I love baseball movies, and I wrote a book that I would want to read. And yeah, I agree with you. Like, if I see a book called Baseball, the Movie, I don't care who wrote it, I am definitely buying that book. And I did try to balance, you know, research and original interviews with my opinion about these movies as well, because I think that analysis, you know, is valuable. Talking about Babe Ruth, you know, it is funny. I watched his earlier movies. He was in a movie called Heading Home, I think, in 1930 or something like that, which is like it's like a fictionalized version of his life, sort of a mythologized version of his life. And it's not very good. And then, of course, the Babe Ruth story, which he wasn't in, but is just completely hagiographic, and it makes him out to be like a Christ-like figure.
Right. The Second Coming is
it's really ludicrous. But I think his best performance is in Pride of the Yankees, playing himself, because he really sort of debases himself. He makes himself look like kind of a fool. And to do that in service of Lou Gehrig's story, I think, is actually pretty poignant. And he gives it a real sense of reality as well.
You know, talking about biography movies, you have the Jackie Robinson story, you have Cobb, you have a Babe Ruth story. They're based on actual events. Not exactly. Let's just say the director takes liberties in there. In Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig never promised the kid to hit two home runs.
Nope.
You know, in 42. And we had the author of Red Barber. Where Red Barber is talking about where Pee Wee Reese puts his arm around Jackie Robinson.
Right.
That could not have happened because Red Barber was not there. he was doing the game off of the wire telegraph. So
that's right. We had the two professors on that wrote that book, a whole book on Red Barber.
So but you know what? It's a great moment. It's a great moment in the movie. And right. You know, movie magic and the facts don't always line up, you know, and I think it's OK for a movie to take certain liberties to, you know, dramatize a person's life. And, you know, if we wanted something else, I mean, even a documentary, you know, they move things around sometimes, you know, we have access to life. You know, we're there for lots of it. There are plenty of books written about Jackie Robinson, if you want the real story, as I talk about in the book. But the movies turn him into a myth. And that is really something different. And it serves a different purpose in our society as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said something interesting. The first movie, Pride of the Yankees, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you said, you know, at that time, realism wasn't emphasized. Now you hear, well, the guy batted left-handed. He was a righty. He, you know, but in that, you said there were only 5,000 TVs in America at the time. A lot of people had never seen baseball.
That's and really true. Yeah.
So that was another thing that was very interesting. You talked about how Lou Gehrig, the streak, you know, he left the game. But once you go in, that's another day in the streak. But, you know, all these things that were facts that were not in the movie, people were okay with that.
Yeah, something changed over the years. I think TV, in terms of the baseball movie, definitely has something to do with it. But I also just think when it comes to biographical films, for some reason now we expect a fealty to the facts where I don't think people did back then. Maybe it's because they just didn't have access to as much information to even know the true story. That probably plays a large role. But I also just think we were a sort of a nation of gotcha viewers now, you know, and people mm-hmm. love to point out the things that a movie gets wrong, especially baseball fans, because we take our expertise so seriously. So whenever a baseball movie comes out, not that there are too many of them these days, they're definitely we would notice if something was amiss.
Yes. Yeah. You know, you break this into a couple of parts, how baseball film was built on the American dream, how baseball film built the American dream. That's the Pride of the Yankees, Jackie Robinson story, Watergate baseball, the nostalgia boom, and the boomers have kids and the expansion era. But I want to talk about one of the lesser known movies. I watched this movie. I don't know if Lena ever has. It was Bang the Drum Slowly with a young Robert De Niro. That was a really heartbreaking movie.
Yeah, and actually, it's an interesting pairing with Pride of the Yankees because they're both about movies. They're both movies about baseball players who play in New York who were stricken with a deadly disease and cut down in the primes of their lives. But Bang the Drum Slowly, which came out in 1973, it is based on a novel. It's not based on a true story. It's not a rousing movie like Pride of the Yankees. Nope. There's not a lot of dignity in this movie. It's a very sad, dour movie. I actually think another good comp with it is not a baseball movie, but Brian's Song, the football movie that came out just a year before. This is another movie about a couple guys who become friends on a team, and one of them has this deadly disease. But there's no hope for victory or really even redemption. Like it's basically a movie about how this second string catcher gets a disease and he's going to get released. And then the star pitcher decides to stick out his neck for him and put it into his contract that he can't get released. If he does, then I get released too, which means the catcher basically gets to stay on the team all year and sort of becomes one of the guys over the course of the year. And that's all that happens in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's about this guy sort of leveling up a little bit, becoming a little bit of a better player and being accepted into the brotherhood of these players. And it's very low stakes. And that's kind of what I love about it. And De Niro, of course, is really wonderful in it. Before he was super famous, he hadn't made Mean Streets yet. He hadn't made Godfather Part Two. And in fact, when I was doing the research for the book, I looked at all the news clippings from the time and they were all like all about how he did this new thing called method acting, which like people didn't really know outside of like New York acting circles. Mm-hmm. And that was a big, big part of the story at the time.
Yep.
The Jackie Robinson story. Another fascinating chapter. He played himself. you made a point in the chapter, I believe you said something like, because he was playing himself, people believed whatever was going on. And there was a lot in that movie that wasn't true.
Yeah. I think it was like a tacit endorsement, right? That like, this is fact, because there he is playing himself. And of course, I think the main reason he played himself was because there were no black male stars in Hollywood at the time. There was no one who was kind of famous enough to play Jackie Robinson, because he was more famous than any of them. Yeah, and there's stuff that's fudged in that movie for sure. But, you know, the thing about the Jackie Robinson story that I always find the most interesting is how Branch Rickey is always like as big a character in these stories as Robinson is. And that strikes me as a bit of like white bias. You know, these are movies made by white people and they're meant to assuage and appease white audiences, which at the time is totally reasonable because, you know, baseball wasn't fully integrated yet when this movie came out. This movie was basically an advertisement for integration. But the reason it is that way is because Branch Rickey's assistant was sent to the production to be a technical advisor, and he ended up worming his way into a much larger role in the creative process. He actually ended up credited as a writer on the movie. And he is quoted in the Sporting News as saying, like, my job was to make Branch Rickey look good. And it's quite interesting how that set the template. And now every telling of the Robinson story, of course, features Branch Rickey like almost as much as it does Jackie.
You know, I read your book and I hear, you know, about Branch Rickey, and then there's other things about Branch Rickey. I know it's got nothing to do with your book, but we bring up Branch Rickey and, you know, the Jackie Robinson movie. And I just don't know what to think of him.
Me too.
I think, he basically stole a player from the Negro Leagues. In your chapter, you even talk about how Jackie Robinson, I had never heard this, that there were players in the Negro Leagues that were upset with him because once baseball was integrated, they were out of jobs.
It's a very strange part of integration in baseball that is not spoken about often because it makes it so much more complicated, which is that integration destroyed the Negro Leagues. It was a talent drain, immediate talent drain. And the Negro Leagues were quite important. I mean, they were real black cultural centers. They were black owned businesses. They had little, you know, cultures that sprung up around the stadium and around the teams. And, you know, they weren't perfect by a long shot, but an integration was overall, most people would argue, the right thing. But right. We lost something as well. And that's something that the movies have rarely been able to reckon with.
And speaking about the Negro Leagues, and I admit I have not seen this movie, I probably should, but Bingo Long and the Traveling All-Stars.
Very good movie.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
And that was Richard Pryor was in that, and was James Earl Jones in that?
Yeah,
he was in that. Oh, by the way, he pops up in a lot of baseball movies.
He sure does. He's in The Sandlot, Field of Dreams, Bingo Long, and in a John Sayles movie called Matewan, which is about a strike in West Virginia, a coal miner strike. There is a scene of him playing baseball in that as well. So technically four.
Yeah, you think Kevin Costner is the baseball movie. But I know. No, James Earl Jones.
That's right.
We have in Field of Dreams, I know Len's going to mention this, but I'm going to mention it first. We had Robert Wool on, and he came in. He said that was such a BS type of scene that James Earl Jones gives that speech because he wouldn't be allowed to play back then in 1919 or when the Field of Dreams, you know, took place.
That's a perfect example of the baseball movie being unable to reckon with a lot of these racial realities, because, you know, the whole point of that movie is that what does he say? Baseball reminds us of everything that was once good.
It's not
that simple. And if you look, there's no black players, no dead black players on the field in Field of Dreams because they just are not able to go there.
Right.
Yeah.
And same thing with A League of Their Own.
Yeah.
Had that one person, and we had Erin Carlson on our show, and I know she writes a blurb in your book. That was a very good book, and the movie was very good, but there's that one scene where there's that black female that comes in and catches the ball, and she just gives that look, and you just knew that she was excluded.
They did a good job getting that across in one scene, but obviously there's a lot more to the story that they were able to tell.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in Erin's book, she says that woman was never credited, which I find unbelievable.
That's they're just repeating their mistake.
Yeah.
No, I love when I read, as I'm reading the book, even in the opening, the blurbs from all of the people. And I like looking and saying, oh, Tyler Kepner, we had him on. Erin Carlson, I think, like Jeff just said, we had her on. And then, of course, Jeff said Robert Wool. And of course, you have Bull Durham in the book. Now, we're skipping ahead a lot. We'll go back. We go all over the place. But
of course,
Bull Durham, Robert Wool told us, and he's famous for the candlestick line, was improv. He made that whole thing up. That's one of the best lines.
Yeah, Robert Wool really did understand baseball, right? I mean, he's so perfect in that role. He was in Cobb as well, which is not a great film, but he clearly has a love of the game. And, you know, that is a movie that thrives on its authenticity, Bull Durham. You know, like Ron Shelton, of course, was a real minor league baseball player. And this was his first film that he made. And whether or not you know what is real and what isn't, you can just feel when you watch that movie that it is made by somebody who knows their stuff. And it was different than any other baseball movie that had been made before. We were seeing things, players behaving in ways that we would never have seen in a baseball movie before. We would never see a ball player tell a kid to shut up like Crash Davis does in that movie, just as one example. So the fact that Robert Wool can kind of slip in there and be as authentic as everything else, I think is pretty impressive.
Yeah. And you said that Kevin Costner is like the perfect baseball actor because he can play baseball. He looks the part and he's terrific in that movie.
Yeah. I don't know what it is that makes somebody look like a baseball player, but he just does. And, you know, he can swing like one, too. In fact, I talk about this in the book. You know, Robert Redford sort of raised the bar for authenticity in baseball players with The Natural. I mean, he looked way too old, obviously, but his swing was pretty good. But Costner raised it and it stayed there. Like, I don't think it has come back down since then. And when he was angling for the part, because he wasn't a huge star yet when they were making this movie, I don't think The Untouchables had come out yet. So he was on the rise, but not a bankable star. He took Ron Shelton to the batting cages in Van Nuys, California, because he really wanted to prove to him that he had what it took to authentically portray a professional baseball player. And as I said, it raised the bar. And I think ever since then, we don't tolerate anything less than that in a movie.
You know, as a baseball fan, I was 14 years old when this movie came out, The Bad News Bears. And I thought it was just the greatest movie I ever saw when I was 14 years old. You know,
you were exactly the right age for it.
I definitely was. I don't remember Mel Allen doing any ad for it, but apparently those kind of risque ads.
Yeah, they really leaned into the risque nature of the film. I mean, even, you know, parts of it today, obviously, are still pretty risque. Some of the racial and sexual language that the kids speak in the movie. But it was very controversial when it came out. You know, the Catholic League protested it. The Little League Association threatened to sue them until they realized that the words Little League are never spoken in the movie. And then there were, yeah, these risque ads that sort of just leaned into all of the controversy. I mean, I think the producers would have been thrilled if they got sued by the Little League Association. But that's, you know, that's a movie that's very much of its times. You know, I talk about in the book, the 70s was a kind of demythologizing of the baseball movie where the game wasn't pure and wholesome anymore. Some of that's in Bang the Drum Slowly. Some of that's in Bingo Long. And I think we definitely see that in The Bad News Bears. There's nothing less wholesome than a kid, you know, cursing and fighting and shoving chocolate bars into their mouths.
And, you know, I never, you know, at the time, I didn't think anything of it because I was 14 years old. But now that I'm reading your book, I didn't even think about it. You know, reading your book, I just thought it was a good movie.
You know, and it is a good movie. Like, it is just a good movie. One of the things that I love about it, and Richard Linklater spoke to me about this also because I interviewed him in the book because he remade the movie many years later. What he loves about The Bad News Bears is that it just has so much actual baseball in it. Like Field of Dreams has almost no baseball in it. They talk about it all the time, but there's not that much baseball. So much of the action in The Bad News Bears is actually driven by the baseball. It's not the best baseball you'll ever see because the players are obviously not that good, but it really is baseball driven. And maybe more so than any other baseball film that's been made.
Yeah, maybe that adds to the charm, the fact that they're not that good, because they are not that good. That's, you know, that's how it is.
Yeah, it's real.
We are talking to Noah Gattel. The book is Baseball, the Movie. As you could tell, Jeff and I love this book. I mean, absolutely love it. It's not just, well, it's all baseball movies, but then you've got some chapters, we could call them, I don't know, they break up the movies, you've got one called Bathroom Break, the most popular team in baseball cinema. And you talk about all the teams now, knowing that you're a Met fan. I could tell that right away. But you talk about where things were filmed. You've mentioned Chicago with Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's not a baseball movie, but you have that part where they're in the stadium. They're in Chicago. So you got that chapter. Fascinating.
I call those sections sort of like interstitials. They're in between each of the eras that I delineate. And, you know, it was just a way for me to talk about some movies that aren't necessarily baseball movies, but, you know, people would expect to read about in a book like this. And I wanted to write about. So, yeah, I talk about Ferris Bueller a little. I talk about Good Will Hunting. I mean, I love the scene where he's talking about being in the World Series and meeting his wife that night. It's just an incredible scene. And then I have a whole chapter, or interstitial at least, about The Naked Gun as well, because, I mean, that's not a baseball movie, but there's like 30 minutes of baseball in it. So we have to find a way to talk about it.
When they're at that game, Jeff, right? And he takes the dustbuster to home plate. I mean, I'm sorry, Leslie Nielsen, in that scene, that whole thing where he's, you know, Reggie Jackson is, well, we know Reggie Jackson is the I will kill whatever. that is great when he's the umpire.
Enrico Palazzo. I love it because, you know, that the people who made it actually know baseball because they know exactly what to spoof. You have to know the game to make fun of it that well.
In your section of The Boomers Have Kids, you have The Sandlot, which is, I thought, was a very good movie. Rookie of the Year and Little Big League. Now, my nephew, he's a big baseball fan. I think they wore out the VHS tape of Rookie of the Year and Little Big League.
Those are interesting movies because they get grouped together because they're both about kids in the major leagues, obviously. One is about one who becomes a player and the other one is about someone who becomes a manager. I think Little Big League is a far superior movie because it takes its baseball really seriously. They cast a lot of current at the time and former major leaguers in it. Some actually in speaking parts, not just as in cameos. And, you know, I think that really grounds it because it is such a ludicrous premise that this kid, 12-year-old kid, becomes the manager of a major league baseball team. But the character is really well drawn because he's super smart, like actually ahead of his time and in sort of sabermetric kind of thinking about the game. And then you have this really well directed baseball action. And I think when you put all that together, to me, it's just one of the most interesting and enjoyable baseball movies. Definitely one of the most overlooked baseball movies because I think it kind of got overshadowed by Rookie of the Year. And it also came out just a few weeks before the 1994 strike and people weren't really in such a happy baseball mood at the time.
And it came out, what, a year between each other?
It came out. Yeah, right. There were four kids' baseball movies like within an 18-month period, and that was the last one. So I think people were also a little bit sick of it.
You have a chapter, another one of your, what, you called it what?
Interstitials.
Interstitial. Beer Run, the top 10 baseball scenes in non-baseball movies. And I'm going to start, Hook, I remember that. You know, when Captain Hook wants Peter Pan's son to love him.
Yeah.
And he's like, they have a catch together or whatever, or he throws, I forget.
But he sets up a whole game of pirate baseball.
That's right.
For him,
he sets up the whole game. And I think he shoots one of the, he's like, he's stealing and he shoots him or something. I forget exactly. But you have City Slickers, which we all know, Billy Crystal, huge Yankee fan, but in the movie, wore a Met hat. Why? Yeah.
Because the Yankees did not donate to his comic relief fundraiser, and the Mets did. A rare example of the Mets not being cheap. And it paid off for them because Billy Crystal, in deference to them, wore a Mets hat for the entire movie.
That's a great chapter. I learned another thing in the book. I don't know if people are aware of this. I always thought Angels in the Outfield was a Disney movie, came out in the 90s, I guess. And I thought, great movie. I enjoyed it. But that was a remake. I did not know that movie was made back in the 50s.
Yeah, 1950. And of course, it was called Angels in the Outfield, but the Angels as a team did not exist yet in 1950. So they owned that word only referred to the supernatural beings who helped them in the movie. But it was about the Pittsburgh Pirates, who were a real bottom dwelling team at this time. In fact, Branch Rickey had sold his stake in the Dodgers and was now working for the Pirates. He used his Hollywood connections to get them to make the Pirates the subject of the film. They were vacillating between the Pirates and the Cubs at the time. And it's a pretty good movie. I mean, it's the same concept, except, you know, it's mostly about the manager and less about the kid. This kind of grumpy, lonely, middle-aged guy who, you know, it's sort of Dickensian. You know, he gets visited by this angel and says he's going to help them if he can clean his act up. And that's basically what happens in the movie. Pretty enjoyable movie and really some very well shot scenes. They make the baseball, some of it feels sort of like holy and supernatural. And I think it's a good film that deserves to be rediscovered.
You know, I want to ask you about Moneyball and Trouble with the Curve. Both movies I enjoyed tremendously. I really enjoyed them. As a viewer, I didn't think that. it was the opposite of what they were. You know, Moneyball was about a GM doing his sabermetric thing. Trouble with the Curve is the one about the scouts. I didn't make that connection until I read in your book, but it's a great connection, and I rooted for both of them.
Yeah, I know. It's funny how if you frame it right, they can both be the heroes, but right. It really is the same dynamic because in Trouble with the Curve, Clint Eastwood plays this aging scout who is sort of on the verge of getting pushed out by an analytically minded young general manager played by Matthew Lillard. And of course, the way they portray him in Trouble with the Curve, the GM is just a selfish, young, impudent jerk, which, you know, I guess Billy Bean in Moneyball is a little impudent as well. He's not like a pure hero in that movie. But it's just fascinating to see two movies come out, you know, within 1 year of each other that are looking at the same issue from opposite sides. And I think it just goes to show really how divisive the analytics revolution was in baseball and in the world. And it's a perfect vehicle for Clint Eastwood, who has been making some version of this like old guy who's unwilling to like, you know, give up his place in the world. And he still has something to contribute because of his years of wisdom. He's been making that movie since Unforgiven for like, you know, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And baseball and the analytics revolution was just sort of the perfect vehicle for it. So I think it's a pretty enjoyable movie too, although there are definitely some flaws in it from a baseball perspective.
Sure, sure. And I didn't realize that Moneyball had actual scouts in that room, in that famous room.
Yep, exactly.
That scene, yeah.
Yeah, there was an earlier version of the film that was going to have a lot more like real people in it. It was going to be like kind of semi-documentary, and that ended up getting jettisoned. But the fact that they used some real scouts in that scene, I think, is sort of a vestige of that earlier draft.
Who's Fabio?
Yeah, I love that scene. I think it's hilarious.
Yes.
You know, no, I can't decide. It's a good thing that I'm never asked what the best movie is, because I can never decide between am I going serious, you know, mm-hmm. Field of Dreams? Am I going comedy? But one of the best baseball movies, comedy, Major League, no doubt.
I think it's great. I think it's great. And what I love about it is it does that thing that, you know, you would think more baseball movies would do, which is it takes you through an entire baseball season, you know, from spring training to the playoffs. And you really do feel like you're watching a real team by the end of it. You know, the baseball action is really well filmed. And then you have the comedy on top of that. And it is really like it's a Bad News Bears template, basically. Right. I mean, it's a bunch of underappreciated underdogs who learn to get over their differences and come together. But you got so many funny people in it. You know, Wesley Snipes and Charlie Sheen are incredible. The manager, I think, is so funny in that movie. Corbin Burnson is amazing in that movie. It's just a perfect setup. And they executed it incredibly well.
And of course, we all know that that movie is about the Cleveland, well, then Indians. Mm-hmm. But it was not filmed there. It was filmed in Milwaukee.
Very ironically, because this is a movie that really tries to position itself as, you know, working class and everything, connecting the team of underdogs with the underdog city of Cleveland. And then they went to Milwaukee to film because Milwaukee is not a union town. So it was cheaper to film there. Right. And again, that kind of thing wouldn't fly today, but I guess they got away with it back then.
And the sequel to that, Major League Two, not as good a movie, but when the Mets... Okay, well, you're nodding your head. You maybe th- think that it is. But when the Mets were losing, I think they started this season like 0-5 and they won one. And then so right away, I thought to myself, you win two. You know, that's two in a row. You win another. That's called a winning streak. It's been known to happen.
It has happened before.
I see that video on my Twitter feed from Mets Twitter at some point every year, because there's always a swoon where you feel like this team's never going to win another game. And it is amazing how that movie has produced so many memes and so many moments that really have just lingered.
Oh my gosh. I admit I post. One hit.
Oh, Bob Uecker is the best.
And I always think, too, there's always one team every year that makes me think, well, there's only one thing left to do. Win the whole effing thing.
So let's talk about Bad News Bears for a second. So that Bad News Bears, the original, great movie, but they made two more after that. Are we agreed? Not that good.
I thought the second one was okay. I thought it had some good stuff in it. I liked the scenes in the Astrodome, but obviously not on par with the original. And then the third one, Bad News Bears Go to Japan, one of the worst movies ever made. They just took everything that was good about the original and jettisoned it. I don't understand what they were thinking.
Yeah. You know, in the last part of the book, and we're talking to Noah Cattell, the author of Baseball, the Movie. You have something called the expansion era, which it talks about other films that you don't really delve deep into, but I have heard or watched some of them. I mean, The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which I thought was a great movie. And if it's on streaming services, people should watch that one. There's one here called, and let me get to it, A Mile in Their Shoes, A Mile in His Shoes.
Yeah.
About a kid with Asperger's. Not a kid, but a pitcher with Asperger's. And I with Dean Cain, who played Superman, I thought that wasn't bad. Tell you the truth,
I didn't love it, but I thought it was interesting. You know, it definitely drew from some classic baseball movie tropes, right? It's about a scout whose car breaks down and he finds the phenom on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting about that movie is I located in this trend of what I call faith-based baseball films, and there's a lot of them that came out over the last 10 years or so. But, you know, if you're not in that world, you don't really know about them. Many of them go straight to DVD. You can buy them in the bin at Walmart, or they go to these Christian streaming services that exist. And it's just funny to me how some of these movies that have plots that would be very natural for a baseball movie in, say, the post-war period or even in the 80s, maybe, they're sort of relegated now to this just Christian faith-based world. And as I said, these movies are being pumped out. Like there's probably 15 or 20 of them that have come out in the last 10 years or so, but they just never break through to the mainstream. So I list a few of them in that chapter, and there are some that I think are pretty decent. There are also some that are quite terrible because, depending, I guess, on how devout they are, some of them they won't even pull from like the normal pool of actors and craftspeople. They only pull from like the Christian universities, and unfortunately, that usually produces a less quality product.
Right. And then there's a film with John Hamm, the title of
Million Dollar Arm.
Million Dollar Arm. He goes to India to find a couple of cricket players.
Yeah.
And there's a movie here in chapter 17 called Sugar, made in 2008. I did not see that movie. I probably slapped myself in the head because I should should watch that movie. And I will at some point. But could you talk about Sugar?
I'd love to. Yeah. When I talk to a lot of baseball people, and I'm like, what's a baseball movie you wish more people had seen? Invariably, the answer was Sugar. It's an independent film, played at the Sundance Film Festival in 2008. It didn't make any money. It appeared on a couple year-end top 10 lists, but kind of disappeared after that. And I think part of the reason it disappeared is because it tells a story that, you know, baseball doesn't really want us to think about very much, which is about a Dominican player who is signed, comes to the States, playing for a minor league team in Iowa, and really has a hard time assimilating, has a hard time playing. And halfway through the film, he makes a decision, which you don't see much in baseball movies, which is that he quits and he goes to New York and he tries to just kind of build a new life there away from baseball. And, you know, that happens to a lot of players. Like most players don't make it. But we don't usually see a lot of movies about them. And that's what I think makes Sugar so interesting.
Noah, recently I was on an airplane, movies at my seat, and I've seen this movie. If I said 50 times, that would not be an exaggeration, but I had to watch it again. Now, it's in your book. Now, this podcast is baseball and barbecue. It's not MLB baseball and barbecue. It's baseball. So we could talk about anything to do with baseball. And we've had people that have written about this movie, have played in the actual league, and you have a chapter on it. And a lot of people may say that that's one of their favorite movies, and it is a league of their own, one of the best baseball movies.
I think it's my favorite. I mean, I have it and Bull Durham sort of right next to each other. But I think, if gun to my head, I think A League of Their Own is my favorite, because it's just the best movie about baseball. Like, I don't know that the baseball in it is better than any other movie, although I think it's better than people thought it would be. I think they take the baseball pretty seriously, actually, in that movie. And especially during the tryout sequence at Wrigley Field, there's some really good baseball on display in this movie. But it's such a great story. It's a great history lesson, which the world needed. When that movie came out, I was 12. I didn't know anything about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. But it's got such fantastic characters. I mean, the storyline between Dottie and Kit, I think, is so rich. I mean, in a way, they could have been anywhere. It didn't have to be baseball because the characters are so good. But of course, it's better in baseball. It has Tom Hanks at this amazing moment in his career, right before he's getting into drama. But he has some extra kind of heft to his performance that we hadn't seen from him before, and is still amazingly funny. And then you've got this final moment when she drops the ball, which to me, it's one of the great lingering questions of cinema that everyone has an opinion on, and there is no correct answer. And that really has helped this movie stay in the imagination of America for so long, that we can continue to talk about it, continue to think about it. Joe Posnanski wrote about it in his recent book. I mean, it really is an important baseball moment in a way. To me, it takes the movie to a whole other level.
Now, let me ask you, if Marla Hoosh does not get married, do they win the World Series?
100%. Nobody ever talks about this. She was their best hitter.
I know.
And she just left. I mean, they wouldn't be down, you know, they wouldn't be up by one run at that point in the game. They'd be up by probably like three or four runs. Right. They might not have even gotten to a seventh game.
Exactly.
Nobody ever talks about that. I love that you brought that up.
When you that movie... Go ahead, Jeff.
No, finish up your thought.
No, I was just going to say, when that movie ends and that song by Madonna, the women are playing, and that song by Madonna comes on, "This Used to Be My Playground," I could listen to that, watch it over and over, and I've done it. That's just the perfect ending to that movie.
Yeah, you know, I've heard some people say that the movie would be better if you lopped off the prologue and the epilogue with the, you know, the older people in it. But I got to tell you, the older I get, the more that stuff really hits me hard. You know, because baseball is a young person's game, unfortunately, for men and women. And, you know, I like to think I could still make contact against a 90 mile an hour fastball. But fortunately, I'm never going to get the chance to find out.
That's not true. Go to Mets Fantasy Camp. You're old enough to go to Mets Fantasy Camp.
Oh, man.
I've done it once. It is great. And you do go up against major league pitchers. I mean, and even though they're retired, they can still bring it.
How'd you do?
I had a triple, which was good. I was against a player, but I did get a foul tip off of Heath Bell and Nelson Figueroa. I hit the ball.
I could die happy if I did that.
I'm telling you, it's worth it. All right. I got to get a little controversial, because Len is not in favor of this, and looks like you are, the World Baseball Classic. Mm. You said it's a good thing for baseball. It's a worldwide thing. It brings baseball to all the countries. And you're in favor of it. And I know my cohort here, Len, is not too thrilled with it.
Well, I'm the one who lost my closer last year from it, and I'm still in favor of it.
Yeah. Len, we all lost our closer. Right, Noah?
That was tough, for sure. I don't know that the Mets were going anywhere last year, even with him. But the point I make in the book, I do like the World Baseball Classic. I had a good time watching it, but I like it because I feel like it might open up some possibilities for the baseball movie. Because one of the issues with the baseball movie, one of the reasons they're hard to get made then and now, is that baseball movies historically have not had much of an audience outside the U.S. right? The only baseball movies that have really done well outside the U.S. are Moneyball and Field of Dreams. And I think that's because they had a huge movie star, like his face on the poster. And baseball movies often are ensemble movies, and you know they're not always driven by stars. But there is this conventional wisdom that they won't play overseas, that baseball is strictly an American thing. And these days, more than ever, the overseas box office is important in the calculus of getting a movie made. So my hope is that if baseball does continue to grow internationally, and hopefully the WBC is doing that, that that might create an opportunity to redefine what a baseball movie is. And I also just think the WBC would be a great place to set a baseball movie because you've got so many interesting stories. You've got old guys hanging on. You've got young guys going up against major leaguers who never would have the opportunity otherwise. I just think that would be a really cool kind of ensemble movie.
Absolutely. We're talking with Noah Cattell. The book is Baseball, the movie. Noah, we could have gone an hour more because this is such a great book. We could talk about all the movies in here, but we want people to buy it. I do have one final question for you. And I know you have a Substack page and you're doing some rankings of movies right now. I've been perusing the internet, which is the old source of truth, of course. I have a couple of these rankings here in front of me. Mm. And looking at, I think four of them I hear, all of them have Bull Durham as number one. And I don't want you to reveal your number one because you want people to read your Substack. You know, it looks like Bull Durham is like the top baseball movie.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, I think it's definitely up there for me. I think there are some people who would say Moneyball, although I think Moneyball actually plays better with non-baseball fans. That seems to be like their favorite baseball movie. I think there's a lot of people who would say A League of Their Own. There's definitely some Sandlot people out there for sure. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ball players love Sandlot. You know what other movie that ball players love? They love For Love of the Game with Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
They always, I talked to a few of them for this book, and they all said that that movie was really accurate in terms of showing how players survive out on the field, how they can clear, like, drown out the audience and how they can kind of get focused and get in the zone. I think the baseball stuff is good in that movie, but the love story stuff, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think Bull Durham is definitely up there. But you know, the good news is there's enough baseball movies, good ones, where a case can be made for several of them. And I think that's good. I'm not about definitive rankings, although of course I have my own. I like it when we continue to debate these things because I think it keeps the genre alive.
Absolutely. And one of the movies that we did not talk about in the book in depth, but one of my favorites was Eight Men Out. It's based on a true story. Not historically accurate, but based on a true story, which everybody should see. It's a very important movie, too.
I thought it was great. And John Sayles, who wrote and directed that movie, I was lucky enough to get him to write the foreword for this book, which was a terrific honor. He is a great baseball fan. If you could ever get him on your show, he's just one of these guys, these older guys who just wants to talk about old baseball players all day long. You guys would have a ball with him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you for the suggestion. We will reach out to him when we get the chance. So, yeah, why don't you tell us, everybody, where they can get the book? It's available in May. All your social that you want people to know.
Sure. So it comes out May 14th, but it is available for pre-order right now. You can get it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Bookshop and all the normal places that one buys books. I can be found on Twitter at Noah Cattell. That's kind of my main social media channel. I'm on Instagram and TikTok as well. On TikTok, I review baseball caps, by the way. So if you're into the baseball caps, as many people are these days, you might want to find me over there. And I'm going to have a lot of events coming up. I've got two events in New York promoting the book. I'll have a big West Coast swing. So follow me on Twitter if you want to get all the latest news on that.
Nice. So Noah, I have one more for you, not really related to the book, but when is the next big baseball movie coming out? What do you think?
Big baseball movie, I don't know, but there are signs that a revival is coming. There have been a number of documentaries, of course, lately. You know, The League came out last year. A Roberto Clemente documentary just played the South by Southwest Film Festival. That'll be coming out later this year. There was a movie that came out in January called Night Swim about a haunted pool, which was not a baseball movie, but the lead character in it was a baseball player, and there was a surprisingly large amount of baseball talk in it. And there's a couple other movies that are supposed to be coming out soon that sort of approach it similarly, where baseball is not the focus, but it's part of the story. So I feel like we're inching closer to a proper baseball movie, and I'm hopeful, pie in the sky stuff here, that my book will encourage that, move that along a little quicker.
Well, yeah. We encourage everybody to get the baseball, the movie. Noah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. You, Noah. This is my favorite thing to do, is just talk with guys like you about baseball movies. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Noah. Now, I used to think I had a favorite baseball movie, but now, after reading that book, I think I have many favorite baseball movies. Well, let's put it this way. I have many more movies that I want to see. Even if I've seen them, I want to see them again, and I want to look for things that go along with the book. So thank you very much, Noah Gattel. Thank you, Mo Kayson. Jeff, two authors, and one from the world of baseball, one from the world of barbecue. We are presented to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But everybody knows at this point, we're not starting. We're stopping. We're ending it. And how do we end the show, Jeff?
With the musician.
That is Dave Dresser.
And the poet.
Shel Krakowski.
And the song.
Baseball always brings you home.
And we'll see you next week on episode 240.
Peace.